Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
Oh, but of course, Steve is actually not here this week. Steve is in Scotland until next Wednesday. You're stuck with me for the foreseeable future, but we have had proof of life of Steve in Scotland. I think he's having a great time. Hopefully we'll hear from him at some point this week, but hopefully he's also just enjoying his well-earned vacation. In other news, I guess it was a slow news weekend. It's just nothing happened, right? It was wow. Of course, on the last show on Friday, we had just woke up to the news between Israel having strikes against Iran, so we'll catch up with what has been happening there. There was a big parade, there was many protests, and of course, overshadowing, I think, personally, all of it, is the tragedy in Minnesota. So we're going to go into depth about all of that today. But as always, on a Monday morning, Matt Smith, political director for Channel 12 and co-host of Upfront, joins us on the phone because he is on assignment. And so, Matt, I have to ask, how often with a show that is usually, you film it before it airs on Sunday, how often do weekends like this happen where what ends up being pre-recorded and airing on Sunday is small potatoes compared to the news that's happening in real time?
More often than I would like.
Yes.
Yeah. No, we came in and made some tweaks, obviously, with the huge and shocking developments over the weekend. But yeah, I mean, it is an example of just how fast and furious the news pace is. Sometimes, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country, right?
Absolutely. And so let's start there, because I know we have some clips from what some of the interviews that did air yesterday.
Yeah.
But as far as what we know so far about the connection of Vance Bolter, obviously the shootings that happened in Minnesota, but there was over 70 people on that list, including people in Wisconsin. So what do we know so far about the connection between him and Wisconsin lawmakers?
Yeah, so arrested late last night, I think that has put a lot of people at ease.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Both in Minnesota and neighboring states. We know now that close to a dozen Wisconsin lawmakers were on this list that he had of dozens of lawmakers in several states. You know, some have described it as a manifesto. Some law enforcement officials say a target list. I mean, whatever it is, it's awful. And these lawmakers became incredibly nervous, right, when they learned, when law enforcement learned, not only in Minnesota, but Wisconsin, Illinois, some other neighboring states, especially when this guy was on the loose, the potential for what could come next. There was immediate action taken. There was, of course, increased security at the Democratic State Convention in the Dells this weekend. And just a lot of nerves for these Democratic lawmakers, not only here in the state of Wisconsin, but across the region.
Now, I had some different text messages happening over the weekend when we learned that there were 11 Wisconsin lawmakers. And so that list has not been released to the public, correct, as far as who those people were? Does the media have, who gets to decide who gets access to that list in situations like this?
Well, listen, I mean, law enforcement has not released the list publicly yet.
Okay.
So there are scenarios, for example, through sourcing where we confirm the names of the people on the list, right? In other states, some in Minnesota, like Senator Klobuchar, for example, came out and said, I was on that list and publicly spoke about it. I mean, on the flip side, Kristen, there was a major security concern, right?
Yeah.
In terms of whether that would be made public, and to my knowledge, no one has made that list public in terms of people who are reporting on this know who is on that list because of those security concerns, right? Like this is a multi-layer security apparatus, right, in terms of the major concern that especially was playing out Saturday into Sunday. So I would assume at some point, whether it be in the trial or however, I mean, this is evidence at this point that whole list would become public, but perhaps not until the trial, since this now is considered an ongoing investigation.
Well, we'll certainly be following that. I know I've seen some statements from different Wisconsin lawmakers that kind of gives me an indication of people who were alerted they were on the list, but nothing for sure yet. And like you said, the change of tone and the nervousness that must have happened that was at the Wisconsin Democratic Convention in the Dells this weekend. I mean, it had to have totally changed how people were feeling while they were gathered there for what normally would have been a, you know, stuff that they were trying to get done. Obviously, we have a winner now of the new chair. But have you heard from anyone as far as what the feelings were like as this news broke on Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Democrats told me that it was, I mean, a difficult weekend is how a lot of people put it because of what happened in Minnesota. I mean, listen, you have some Wisconsin lawmakers who know these Minnesota lawmakers personally, mm-hmm. right? Like, we are their neighbors. And in terms of Democratic agendas, I mean, you work with neighboring states in terms of how you look to prioritize legislation or what another state has done. So, I mean, it's not like the border is up and there's a wall between Minnesota and Wisconsin. So this is personal for a lot of lawmakers. And for those nearly dozen, the 11 that were on the list, I mean, there were some that had extra security and were removed from their homes. I mean, so there was an active security apparatus around these lawmakers up through the arrest, and I would assume still continuing as this investigation unfolds.
Got it. Well, the convention did not get canceled, despite higher security. We do have a new chair for the Wisconsin Democrats. Devin Remiker did win. Did you hear any reactions from people as far as how the vote went? Any parts of the speech and how people are feeling now that the baton has been passed?
Yeah, and like I think Minnesota completely overshadowed what this would have been perhaps the dominant story coming out of Wisconsin, right, this weekend. I've heard a couple things, Kristen, and I'm sure you have as well. I think, A, there was a little surprise at how close it was.
Oh, really?
Did you not hear that? I've heard that from a couple.
Well, I saw, was it 485 to 415? Well,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. I think, A, I don't think a lot of people were necessarily surprised. I think some sensed it was going in this direction. I mean, the Ben Wickler endorsement, I kind of feel was a game changer.
Yeah.
I think, and it was looked at differently, right, for supporters of Devin as opposed to supporters of Joe Sopecki. Both, I think, would agree that it was a game changer in different ways they would look at it. I think it'll be curious and interesting to see how the party evolves and the reaction that now comes in the coming weeks once Devin officially takes the reins.
Well, we will see how he handles the next big question, which is whether or not Tony Evers is going to run for re-election. You talked to State Senator Kelda Royce about that decision, so we will hear more about that and plenty of other topics. After this, we are talking to Matt Smith, political director for Channel 12 and co-host of Upfront here on Point Taken. Well, welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve Scafidi is on vacation, but we are joined, as we always are on Mondays, by Matt Smith, who is the political director at Channel 12, and on the road, not in with us in person, but you had a chance to talk to State Senator Kelda Royce last week, who is a member of the Joint Finance Committee. And prior to last week, I think, was it an interview with you guys where she kind of had a veiled shot at Governor Evers of saying something along the lines of, you know, Wisconsin tends to like two-term governors, but she is still a little bit more vocal than many elected Democrats, it seems like, as far as trying to push him to make a decision, correct?
A couple weeks ago. So we were interested to follow up on those comments. Kind of the first time she said that publicly, just right before everyone headed to convention and all the talk is he going to run? Is he going to run?
Exactly. So let's hear what Kelda Royce had to say.
Do you want Governor Evers to run for a third term?
Well, he's going to make that decision. I think the good news is that Democrats around the state are really, really energized. We see what is happening in this country. Republicans are trying to shred the social safety net so that they can give a tax break to the wealthiest. And we're in a great position. We've got a great bunch, and we're going to be in wonderful shape to win majorities in 2026 and have a Democratic trifecta.
So you would like to see Governor Evers do what?
I'd like to see him make a decision, hopefully sooner rather than later, because I do think we've got a lot of elections that we need to be winning and focusing on.
So now Kelda is obviously an elected official, longtime elected official on the Joint Finance Committee. There was also more talk, I think, inside of Democratic circles last week. Dan Schaefer, editor, publisher of the Recombobulation Area, wrote his own op-ed very pointedly saying he does not think Tony Evers should run again, which started some conversation. Was that conversation had from what you've heard this weekend in the Dells?
I mean, I think it is being had. How loud it is, I don't think we know yet. I think a lot of Democrats came out and said, yes, we're going to back the governor if he runs for re-election, and a lot of Democrats will do it. But it will be curious to see how many take the approach of Senator Royce, who don't necessarily come out and say, yes, 110% Tony Evers should run for a third term. The question, you know, that answer was almost kind of like the Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden answer, right? Like, he has to make up his mind. I hope he makes up his mind soon. So I'll be fascinated, Kristen, to see, like, does this increase in loudness in terms of the number of people who say these types of comments before the governor makes his decision as we get, I mean, I would assume close if the budget is going to be done anytime soon.
Well,
who knows on that front?
That's kind of just like the strategy, the political strategy behind this. Why would he make a decision before the budget is done, making himself, if he decides not to run, a lame duck governor?
Yeah.
And so the conversation
Correct.
Before the budget seems ill-timed.
Yes, and he can, right. Like, I mean, and whether he knows or not what his decision is, nobody really knows, right? Besides him. And you're right. He can't publicly come out before the budget and then be a lame duck governor in terms of what he wants to get accomplished with the budget. And some people I've talked to, he may very well still be going back and forth and not totally made up his mind yet on whether he's going to run again. So it's going to be interesting to see how much pressure from all sides, right? Like, Democrats start to come out and say, I don't know. Or they say, yes, we need the governor to run to win. It'll be interesting to see how loud that becomes before he actually says anything.
Exactly. So, and one of the many things that kind of did get lost in the news cycle was last week there was moves from the Joint Finance Committee, or at least the Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee, when it comes to special education funding and also a tax cut plan. Could you quickly summarize what is moving forward for them?
Yeah, so Republicans kind of solidified their tax cut plan, which we believe was similar, if not exact, to what the governor had said he would agree to if Republicans would have increased spending on things like education, the UW system, child care. So the tax cut plan, it looks at two big things, among others: retirement income, looking to keep more retired people in the state longer and not necessarily go to Florida or Arizona for half of the year. And then it expands the second lowest tax bracket. Republicans say it would equate to about a 1% tax cut for that bracket. On education funding, it does increase in terms of the percentage of special education from about 32% to 37%. But the governor and Democrats were looking for 60% reimbursement.
Yeah.
So they are still a long ways off on that. And we talked with Senator Royce, and she said the governor should absolutely veto this budget because of just the education component alone.
Well, we will see as that develops this week what will happen. But let's take one more break, and when we come back, you got a chance to talk to Milwaukee County Chief Judge Carl Ashley as he is talking about federal immigration officials and trying to have a new policy to have a little bit more clarity on what judges should be doing. So we are talking to Matt Smith from Channel 12. Stay with us. I'm Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve Scafidi is on vacation. We are talking to Matt Smith for a couple more minutes before we let him go to his assignment on location. We'll see him next week. But you also had a chance to catch up with Milwaukee County Chief Judge Carl Ashley this weekend. And he said that he's talking with federal immigration officials, trying to prepare a new courthouse policy that's coming to fruition. Obviously, this is in the aftermath of the arrest of Judge Hannah Dugan. And so, so as far as what do we know about what clarity they're looking for?
So, I mean, in terms of policies, right, like the whole thing centers around this disagreement about where and how federal officials, ICE, can use courthouses or courtrooms, right, to arrest people and put them into federal detention. And this obviously exploded into the national conversation with the arrest of Judge Dugan, who the U.S. Department of Justice accuses her of helping an undocumented immigrant evade federal ICE officials after appearing in her courtroom.
So let's hear a little bit of what Judge Carl Ashley had to say.
So there's some discussions, recent discussions, on how we can collaborate and come up with an understanding. Because what we want to do in Milwaukee County is we want to be able to handle our proceedings. We don't want our proceedings to be interrupted, to be interfered with. We also understand that in the public hallways, that's a different issue. And so we want to make sure that we support what we need to do and they respect it, and then we respect what they have to do. And so we're working on something, and I've had ongoing contact with them.
Based on these conversations, do you think the arrest could have been prevented?
Well, that's a $1 million question there, Matt. I don't know.
That is a $1 million question. Do you feel like he had an answer to that and maybe didn't want to give it?
No, I honestly think he pondered it for a second.
Okay.
Because there's very serious and strong views on all sides of this, right? On whether the arrest was proper, whether what the judge did was proper or not, whether she did anything wrong or not. And I think in this new age with the Trump administration, the question moving forward, and he acknowledged it. He goes, listen, I am talking with ICE because, yes, they have their job to do, but I am also talking with local partners. And guess what? Not all judges within the Milwaukee County Courthouse have the exact same opinion on what a policy should be or what should happen inside our courthouse.
Now, when a policy comes out, would this just be for Milwaukee, or is this something that's going to be applied across the state, across the country?
It would just be Milwaukee County. Okay. So this would just specifically be for the Milwaukee County Courthouse in terms of where Judge Ashley has jurisdiction.
Got it. All right. Well, we have a little bit less than a minute left with you. What are you looking at for coming up this week?
Yeah, listen, I mean, a number of things. I think how this Minnesota case develops, right? Not only that, but the impact here in Wisconsin. Joint Finance Committee is going full steam ahead with meetings this upcoming week in terms of the UW system, more funding, so the budget is moving forward. How those conversations progress and what the governor does will be very fascinating.
As always, all right, well, good luck today, Matt. We will see you next week on Monday. Thanks, as always.
Have a good week, Kristen.
All right, Matt Smith, political director for Channel 12. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is on vacation. And it was a busy, busy weekend. I think going into the weekend, we obviously knew that there was going to be protests across the country. A big parade was happening on Saturday. It was obviously Father's Day weekend. Heading into, obviously, when we started the show on Friday, we were still gathering news around what was happening with Israel's strike on Iran, and we're going to have an update on that later in the show. But I think what overshadowed everything is another act of political violence and a tragedy that happened in our neighbor state. Obviously, we now know, I mean, it was a manhunt for a while, but police have arrested Vance Bolter, for the killing of Democratic Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband. Hortman was the state's top House Democrat, so basically their Robin Voss, except a Democrat, is for her leadership role in their state legislature. And she championed legislation protecting reproductive rights and a ban on conversion therapy for minors, and worked on the legislation that had guaranteed paid family leave and medical leave. But what we know so far is that law enforcement tracked Bolter into a rural wooded area near his home after a 2-day manhunt. And we know that he impersonated a police officer, both when he shot Melissa Hortman and her husband, but also he shot, but they survived, State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. And he was carrying a list, at least authorities say he was carrying a list of 70 targets, including politicians and Planned Parenthood locations. And 11 or 12, it sounds like, of those were Democratic elected officials. And I feel like when the news first broke on Saturday, at least when I first heard the news on Saturday, it's one of those weird things that how we ever choose to compartmentalize tragedy especially when you are a big news consumer. I would consider myself a big news consumer, someone who's admittedly addicted to my phone and to scrolling. And there's certain tragedies that I feel like hit me really, really hard immediately. I would say school shootings tend to do that. As anyone was listening on air the day of the Madison school shooting, I pretty openly lost it on air. I would say there's certain images that come out of war overseas that can hit me pretty hard. But then there's a lot of times where things just kind of get compartmentalized because you have to keep going with your day, and to feel everything really deeply in real time all the time would leave you incapable of functioning and getting on with your day. And so I think with the busyness of this weekend, my parents were in town. We had lots of plans. We went to my father-in-law's yesterday. It wasn't until last night that I kind of let myself feel how scary and terrible this shootings were. And I think it's also partially because it's close to home. You know, I think for me personally, I have a lot of friends who work in politics. I have a lot of friends who are elected official. Now, more of them are Democrats. If Steve were here, more of his circle of friends are Republicans. But I think when you work in the business that we work in, and you know people who have chosen to run for these positions, and you know that for the most part, they're just normal people who care and who want to see the state be better, or if it's a local position, see our city be better. And the sacrifice of their time, the sacrifice of more money they could be making if they were in the private sector, but also now to the point that it's the sacrifice of their safety, that there are people out there who want to kill them. And it's not our top politicians. It's not the Nancy Pelosi's or the Chuck Schumer's or the Mitch McConnell's or this U.S. Supreme Court and the highest ranking, most notable politicians and officials in the country. It's state legislatures. Like, I didn't know who Melissa Horman was. I couldn't have picked her out of the lineup as far as knowing what power she had and who she was in Minnesota. I know national stuff. I know Wisconsin stuff, but I didn't know who she was. And how quickly it can get lost and just keep moving forward. And just to sum it up as another act of political violence, instead of kind of taking a moment to understand what this is doing to the moral corruption of where our politics are. I mean, think about just what's happened this year alone. Governor Josh Shapiro, the Pennsylvania governor, Josh Shapiro's home was set on fire. There was a firebombing at the Republican Party headquarters in New Mexico. And we're approaching the year anniversary of the attempted assassination of President Trump last July. And I don't know how we tone down the rhetoric. I mean, literally this morning, before we even got to this topic, we got a text on the text line from someone who said, "Democrats are a joke. Just wish they would quit shooting people." What a terrible, depraved, flippant thing to say in the aftermath of this. And we'll get back to that, because I'm not going to say what's worse. But on top of all of this is the internet rhetoric that happens when political violence happens. It's how quickly we want to figure out whose side was this person on, and then point fingers and say, "See, look how dangerous that side is." But maybe, just maybe, people who are willing to do things like this don't think logically, don't think rationally, don't fit just tightly into one political party's box of who they're rooting for, whose team they're on. And maybe it's adding to the political violence rhetoric by trying to put them on a team. So I'm going to dive a little bit more into that and a personal story about that after this. Well, Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and we're spending this half hour kind of debriefing thoughts on what happened in Minnesota and what we know so far. Like I said, Lance Bolter has been apprehended after allegedly murdering Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, and also shooting State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, who have survived. And as I was just talking about, there's the obvious allowing yourself to actually feel how terrible this is. But there's also the political rhetoric and online rhetoric that comes after political violence happens. And so often it is the immediate dive into what we know about this person and trying to put them on one of the teams. Are they conservative or are they liberal? Are they Republican or are they Democrat? Who did they vote for? So that one side can feel a sense of relief, I imagine, that it's not their side. And the other side can say, see, this is you. This is you guys who are dangerous. This is you who's spreading the violent rhetoric and making things worse. When in reality, that rhetoric is what's making it worse. Instead of just having this be a somber moment where anyone with influence, whether that's someone who's elected or someone who has a massive audience, actually just says how awful this is. And we point out the depravity of being willing to do something, and it's not necessarily because of what team they vote for. Because it is so dangerous trying to elevate these people to the point that this was your team. And this happened this weekend. And it happened. We still don't know that much about the young man who tried to shoot Donald Trump. I know New York Times just tried to, the most thorough, comprehensive look into who that young man was. They published it over the weekend or the end of last week, and we still don't know that much about him. But it's like this need to understand their motivations to feel the relief that it's not our side. But the truth is, it is both sides. Both sides have had people be radicalized to the point that they think the other side is so dangerous that it takes violence to quell it. And, you know, this most recent example of what gets spun online and muddies the waters so that some people with conservative inclinations have a rationale to keep supporting Trump, because all of these MAGA influencers tried to spin this as if this guy, Vance Bolter, was a Democrat. Laura Loomer falsely claimed that he was friends with Walz, Governor Walz, and was associated with the No Kings protests. MAGA influencer Mike Cernovich also blamed Tim Walz, claiming the governor had Hortman executed for voting with one time with Republicans on a bill. Nick Sorter tweeted out more Democrat terrorism. Breitbart and other far-right outlets suggested that to their audiences that Walz was responsible for the shooting, even though he was on the list of targets. Charlie Kirk of Turning Points blamed the shooting of Democratic lawmakers and their family members on anyone who objects to rising fascism. Like, this is a campaign to confuse people. But even more dangerous is the fact that it signals to would-be terrorists that if they take action, they can expect support from cheerleaders in cyberspace. And also, it creates a narrative that allows people who are thinking about killing someone that they're acting in self-defense, that hurting and killing the other side is justified because that other side started it. And then it gets subscribed to our personal relationships. And I'll end here as far as the end of my oldest friendship because of something like this. My oldest friend, who literally was born a month before me, and I've been friends with since birth because our moms shared. I would go to his house after school sometimes. He would come to my house after school sometimes. And as he grew up, he became much more conservative than you guys all know that I am. And he lives in Atlanta. And over the last couple years, we would spar via text over politics. He would send me a tweet. I'd try to defend it and vice versa. But it would always end with us sharing pictures of our kids or catching up. And when he would be in Wisconsin, we would catch up. And the day that the attempted assassination happened last July, I didn't have my phone on me for the most of the day. I didn't know what had happened at first. And the first time I even realized what did happen was I got a text from him saying, "You are not on the side of the good guys." And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then pretty quickly after that, I found out what he was talking about. And I tried to tell him, I was like, how could you ever put me in that bucket, that this is something that I would ever support? And I am so wildly offended as one of your oldest friends that you would put me there. And his response was, "You're not the victim here." And I blocked him, and I haven't talked to him since. Because to think that anyone that is rational in your life can justify this kind of violence is insane. So I hope that we can stop doing this. I don't know how we'll stop doing this because it's only getting worse, it feels like. But with that, when we come back, I wanted to play something from Senator Amy Klobuchar talking about her friend, Melissa Hortman, so we can get to know a little bit more about who she was and what her career was. So stay with us on Point Taken. We're running a little behind, but I did want to take a chance to play a little bit of a tribute that U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar put online this weekend to talk about her friend, Representative Melissa Hortman. We're not going to have time to play the whole thing, but I wanted to give at least the first minute of it before we head to news.
He asked me to share a few words about Minnesota and the loss of my friend, Melissa Hortman, who was the Speaker of the House of Minnesota for years, extraordinary legislator. And I just feel like sometimes when you hear about political violence, it's just statistics and it's just numbers, or it's just someone you've never heard of. But I want you to know Melissa, because she's an incredible person. I got to know her when we both had young kids starting out in politics. Watched her door knock her district, and literally it felt like she knew everyone in it. I'd be on one side of the street, she'd be on the other. She'd have me come over and say hi. I was in county government. And from there, she took off. She finally won her seat. She tried a few times. That's kind of maybe a lesson for everyone. And then she ended up doing everything from raising those kids while in the legislature with her lovely husband, Mark, who we also lost, to being a Girl Scout leader and teaching Sunday school. She also trained dogs for vets, service dogs. And what you need to know about her is that she was this incredible leader when, I'm just not sure, a lot of women weren't in power back when we started out. And she just did everything the right way for the right reasons.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
Hello, hello. Indeed, Steve is not here this week. He is having a grand old time with Gene Miller over in Scotland. I've been seeing some pictures. It looks like they are having a great time. Unclear about how the weather is, but I will shoot him a text later today to check in. Hopefully, maybe we'll hear from him at some point. I think they're about 6 or 7 hours ahead of us, so probably already getting ready for dinner. But moving on to hour two of Point Taken. Now, of the many things that was happening over the weekend, the Middle East is on edge, I guess, is an understatement, because Israel and Iran have been trading strikes at what's reported to be a fairly unprecedented pace. So on Friday, Israeli forces targeted Iran's nuclear program, striking critical infrastructure and killing military commanders and nuclear scientists. And then Tehran, in response, launched drones and missiles into Israeli territory. some of which have been intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome and U.S. forces in the region. But I did hear some reports as far as, you know, because of the Iron Dome, Israelis are not necessarily used to having missile strikes. And it does sound like there has been attacks that have targeted buildings. There are neighborhoods that are in Israel that are have buildings that have been bombed, and at least 14 people have died in Israel. And then there is over 200 that have died in Iran. And then on Sunday, President Donald Trump did call for the two nations to make a deal to end the fighting. And, you know, it matters because the Trump administration so far had been distancing itself from Israel's operation and argued that it would be illegitimate for Iran to retaliate by striking U.S. targets. And then on Saturday night, Trump wrote on his Truth Social account that the U.S. had nothing to do with the attack on Iran, but stressed that if Iran attacks U.S. interests in the Middle East, he will order a harsh retaliation. And so I am no Middle East expert. I am trying to find someone who can join us this week to talk more about why now, how did this action by the Israelis play in conjunction or counter to the nuclear talks we were trying to have with Iran. But it does feel like, from what I've read, the experts are saying that if both countries don't stop soon, the rest of the Middle East could get involved in the fighting. But it's, I don't know, it seems like both countries are doubling down. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a video that Israel will, quote, strike every target tied to Iran's regime. And Iran has promised to open the gates of hell. So that doesn't sound great. And I don't know. I don't know what role we'll end up playing. I think it's an interesting conversation as far as I was having this conversation with my brother, who did vote for Donald Trump this last election. And a large reason was, I think my brother was someone, there's a lot of different reasons, but he liked the idea of Donald Trump saying, we're going to get out of these wars. We're going to get out of Ukraine and Russia, you know, Gaza and Israel. And now we're in, and I don't know if we know how much there was a wink and a nod of, all right, go ahead, when Israel decided to strike, and how much we really didn't have anything to do with it. But it is concerning that all of a sudden there is a third major conflict that we may or may not have to get involved with. And how close this could be getting into territory where a lot more countries are involved. And so, like I said, I am trying to find someone who knows a lot more about this than I do to come on and explain it in layman's terms as far as what we should keep our eyes on. But like we always do on Mondays, at least what we know we can keep our eyes on is Dave Spano having intel on what this could mean for oil prices and gas prices and the markets. And we'll catch up with him about the markets in general and some of the fact that consumers maybe aren't so worried about tariffs anymore and some other news when it comes to your money. So when we come back, we will check in with CEO of Annex Wealth Management, Dave Spano, on Point Taken. Oh, you know what that music means. Dave Spano, CEO of Annex Wealth Management, joins us on Mondays to talk all things markets. Now, Dave, it seems I feel almost silly making the transition or the pivot I made in the last segment to talk about the very, very serious implications of the conflict that's happening between Israel and Iran right now and then talk about, well, how does this affect our money? But it is a fact that this will affect oil and gas prices. And so welcome. We're happy to have you.
Good. And thanks for having me.
And what can you tell us as far as what we should be watching when it comes to the impact this is going to have on oil and gas?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, it's another war is really what it is, and which is a problem, obviously. But it's escalating. The conflict, as everyone knows, between Israel and Iran can have a significant impact on global oil prices. Not only has Israel launched large-scale military strikes on Iran's nuclear and military facilities, but obviously that has an impact on oil. So right now, Iran exports somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day. Most of that goes to China. Now, you might shrug your shoulders at that, but The bigger impact, in my opinion, Kristen, is that the Straits of Hormuz is really, that's the choke point where about 20 to 25% of the world's oil supply goes through the Straits of Hormuz. And if that is disrupted, that could have systemic supply shock issues. And so that is the thing that we're going to continue to watch to see what are they going to do. It does appear that Israel certainly, as of right now, has the upper hand, especially because of their air support. And because of that, it looks like they have, you know, the upper hand and control. So we are going to watch to see if there's some, you know, what's called geopolitical risk premium. In other words, as oil prices go up, and they have. They're up about 7%, and that affects most people.
And how long does it take to, because that was oil today, because this is, I pretend to know some of this stuff, but it's usually just what I'm reading. But as far as what oil costs today and how, when will we see that reflect in gas prices at the pump?
I used to always joke, Kristen, about, you know, back in the day when you go drive by the gas station and all of a sudden the guy read the newspaper that oil's gone up and he's out there on his ladder moving the thing up, right? It hasn't affected him yet. It's not in the tank yet. But we do see a pretty immediate reaction, especially when prices go up. And I joke that they don't come down that fast. But you could have, if you know, when oil prices are up 7%, and that obviously turns into, that's oil. That's obviously not gasoline.
Yeah.
It has to be refined and so forth, and then delivered. So there should be a delay before you start to see gas prices go up, but those in the gas business don't agree with that. So, but you did see them go up. I mean, I personally saw them. I was traveling this past weekend, and gas prices were up.
All right. Well, speaking of consumers and their interpretation of what's happening, I saw this report from the University of Michigan and their preliminary index of consumer sentiment for June. And it showed that the first increase in shoppers' attitudes since December. So does that kind of mean that consumers aren't as worried about tariffs anymore? Have we just kind of acclimated to the atmosphere at hand as far as prices going up or down?
I think there's a delay. And we've seen that. I mean, sometimes, you and I are talking about something that is, you know, as real world data coming through, and that sometimes doesn't sink in, and we don't see the consumers react quite as immediately. But it's certainly not as dominant of a concern as what it was. I mean, early on, I think it was McKinsey's study came out, and 90% of consumers understood that tariffs could become inflationary. And so that meant that, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to change, you know, behavioral shifts? Are they going to change? But today, only about, I don't know what your report says, but, you know, the ones we're looking at show about 25% still think tariffs are a concern, but almost 45% say inflation is their biggest concern. And that is, you know, that is over a longer period of time. And that study came out over the last 5 years. So that was both what happened several years ago under the last administration and this administration and everything they're doing with tariffs. But what does that mean? It means that behavioral shifts are likely. And so people can either cut back on, you know, non-essential items, or they could switch to cheaper brands, or maybe just buy less. And it's really interesting, too, there's a difference between generations as well. So baby boomers are less affected, or they change their behavior less often. That could be because they're older, or they're in a different economic strata. But Gen Z and millennials are more likely to change their habits, and they may go out less, and they might buy a different product. So certainly sentiment has a lot to do with it. Ultimately, for us, when we see that change in sentiment, does it mean they're going to buy less of that widget, whatever it's going to be, and does that affect stock prices?
Well, speaking of inflation, the Federal Reserve is meeting Wednesday, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so any thoughts as far as what Jerome Powell, if you had a crystal ball, what do you think Jerome Powell is thinking right now?
He's going to do what he's been doing and okay. Sit on his hands. And I don't love the idea. You know, they are in a predicament, right? You have to remember that the Federal Reserve looks in the rear view mirror and not out the front window. By the way, I was driving up north over this weekend, and a rock came in. Cracked my windshield.
Oh, no.
So upset about that. But speaking of looking through the front windshield, you know, we look at things like the common man CPI, and that's food and energy and housing and clothing and utilities. Those are the things that really affect us the most, and that's really what we kind of look at that. And it's about 2.5% is what it's running at. And their target is 2%. So they're in, you know, the circle of friendship here, I believe. Then about 2.5% is what they're running. They target 2%. So if they hold it interest rates higher, they probably could slow inflation down a little bit. But they're going to look at what tariffs. If tariffs stay in place right now, then that could be inflationary. So I think they're just in a predicament and are in a wait-and-see mode.
All right. Well, we will be able to wait and see and then talk about it with you on next Monday. But we still have you for one more segment. We're talking to CEO of Annex Wealth Management, Dave Spano. And I'm excited to get your thoughts on this. I read a headline this morning as far as Friday the 13th and its impact on the stock market. So I will ask you about that after this on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve Scafidi is in Scotland on vacation. And as always, in the 11 o'clock hour, we talk to Dave Spano, CEO of Annex Wealth Management, to get his thoughts on what we should be watching in the markets this week. And before we get to a little fun topic, Dave, so the G7 leaders are gathering in Canada. That's the G7 summit is starting today. And what impact do big meetings like this have on the market? Or is it just kind of very powerful people in one spot talking about things, and it doesn't really have an impact on real-time markets?
So the G7 in Canada, of course they're going to be, and you know for sure what they're going to lead with is hockey, right? So
yeah.
The Oilers, right, of Edmonton against the Florida Panthers, game six coming up tomorrow night, and the Stanley Cup, and certainly Edmonton is in a predicament, down 3-2, so they're headed to Florida, so that's going to be a lot of fun to talk about hockey, I'm sure. But more importantly, the G7, of course, is these world leaders get together, and you know, obviously, they're going to be talking about tariffs. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just what's going to happen. And you know, you think about the tariff negotiations; they will not only will they be front and center, but as we know, Trump is using these as a strategic bargaining tool, right? But countries like Japan and Canada, UK, Australia, they've all offered investment incentives, and the EU came in, as you saw, and said a zero-for-zero deal. And so mutual tariff eliminations on a lot of products like pharmaceuticals and machinery. So all of those things are going to be part of the conversation, and there's probably not going to be a unified statement. So let's talk about, you know, how that affects you and I and your listeners is, you know, what happens to car prices and agriculture prices and tech and all of these things. That is really what the conversation is going to be, and does it change consumer sentiment? Back to our last segment, and it really could, but I don't know what comes out of that other than there's going to be a lot of chirping back and forth about tariffs, and they probably will come to some agreement to try to solve it. But you know, this is something that people don't recognize. I don't think the tariff income is helped the tax revenue go up as high as it's been, I think, on record. And mm-hmm. so that revenue is certainly helping us bring in some revenue, and that could offset some of the tax bill as well. So that's the way I'm looking through it is, you know, do we get some progress on tariffs? Does that income stay in place? Because it is temporary, and I don't know how they score it when it comes to the tax bill, which we'll probably see something today, by the way.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, I think the Senate is going to come out with some framework today. So let's pay attention to that as the day goes on.
Got it. All right. Well, this was a very fun topic that I saw from Axios. So on Friday, it was Friday the 13th, and Steve and I talked a little bit about how there was only one Friday the 13th in 2025, but in 2026, there's going to be three, which is the most, I guess, there can be in any given year. So then on Axios this morning, I found it's reported that Friday the 13th is actually really good for stocks. Is this something that you knew, or is this news to you?
First of all, I like reading the Axios. I did miss that, so I'm kind of kicking myself on that guy, but that's a big bunch of baloney, right? So what about one day's gain, right? So I don't know. It's probably 0.1%, one way or the other, right? So it doesn't matter. It really doesn't. It doesn't matter. You know, there's been some good Friday the 13th. I mean, you know, probably I'd say late 89, we got crushed on one day. I think it was down about 6%. But, you know, obviously we had the October of 1987 as well. So there's been bad Friday the 13th in the past.
Okay.
But it's a bunch of baloney. So it's superstition. There's really no evidence at all that any one day is better than the other. Now, if, for example, Fridays are can be what's called, and this is kind of superstition, triple witching hour, which is fun. And that is really when a lot of options expire. So if all of those options expire on a particular Friday, they call it triple witching. And if that Friday is on October the on the 13th, well, you have all of this stuff and all of this the crazy things that you can look at and you know, cards to look at. That's not the way we invest. We invest for the long term. We find good companies, but it is fun to talk about. I'm going to have to go back and read Axios.
I think I sent you the link because I thought this was really fun. But just like you said, it's, it is a very marginal percentage. So I feel like this is something that some data scientists looked at and had some fun with in their Excel sheet to be able to prove a point.
This was fun. Yeah. This was fun today. Thanks.
Absolutely. Dave Spano, as always, thank you for joining us live on Mondays. We will talk to you next Monday. Steve will still be gone, but you'll have me. So thank you, as always.
And on my way, here it comes, the big parade. Marching bands and barricades make way.
The big parade, indeed, indeed, did happen this weekend. Did not get rained out. I know, I think probably depending on what side of the internet you are on, you saw different footage from Trump's military parade celebrating the 250th. Is it anniversary or birthday? I feel like I've seen both.
I mean, I guess it's both because it's like the anniversary of the establishment. A birthday seems very personal, right?
Because I've actually seen the, like what it be referred to as both the anniversary and the birthday. Obviously, it was also coincided with Trump's 79th birthday. Now, the side of the internet I am on, I saw that it was not necessarily the rager that they thought it was going to be as far as huge crowds. The rain, it didn't, like I said, it did not get rained out, but it did lightly rain throughout the day. But it did seem like it was not really about Trump. It was about the history of the army and the, of the military. But I think there was, to a certain extent, it did, no matter what was planned, as we've been saying this whole show, there was a lot of other things happening over the weekend. So maybe the parade itself was overshadowed by political violence, the war, protests happening around the country. But I would love to hear from you. What did you think of the footage that you saw of the parade? Pictures, testimony, anything you read about how people enjoyed it for anyone who was there. Of course, our friend Bill McCaution was there, so I wanted to hear from him of what his experience was, because obviously pictures can be old. You know, pictures can tell have 1,000 words, but sometimes it doesn't paint the whole picture. And so I wanted to have a chance to talk to someone who was actually there. So Bill was nice enough to spend a little time with us before. Literally, he was in the airport on his way back to Wisconsin when we got to catch up with him about what his experience was on Saturday.
Bill, thank you for making time with us before you jump on a plane back to Wisconsin. So how was the parade?
It was super cool. It was, you know, we talked about it on Friday during the Political Power Hour. I wasn't sure what to expect. And it exceeded all my expectations. It was mostly a history lesson in the United States Army, which started as a Continental Army 13 months before we were a country. It was narrated from start to finish. It started from the very beginning in 1775 and worked its way through all the conflicts and wars that the U.S. had participated in. Got to see all kinds of cool equipment, including a Dodge truck from 1918 that still works. So it was a lot better than I expected. And, you know, honestly, I think most school kids should get an opportunity to hear that history in that order because it was so powerful.
What was the coolest thing? Well, either the coolest piece of equipment or the coolest acrobatic stunt or like, what was the most impressive part?
Well, they had about a dozen guys jump out of a plane. That was kind of cool. But I think seeing some of the old equipment, the B-52 bombers and you know, as they went sequentially through all the wars, they would fly over the equipment that was used in those conflicts. Like helicopters were part of the Vietnam conflict, so we saw Black Hawk helicopters. It was just super, super cool. And, you know, it started, I think I texted you guys, there was an Army rock band that was as good as I've seen for a cover band. I mean, they killed it. They had the crowd going before the whole thing started, and it was a celebration of the Army's 250th anniversary. And again, I if you didn't get to be there live, I hope you got to see parts of it at least on television. And it was quite something.
So I think that's the thing as far as for those of us who weren't there, the media coverage, there's a fair amount of pictures that look like it didn't really capture how many people were there, because maybe it was because the length of the parade was enough that people could kind of be dispersed. But as far as how the media and the captured the events, what do you think they got right and what do you think they got wrong?
Well, I think what they got wrong was that this would be about Trump. It really wasn't. It never was. I mean, he gave a very brief speech near the end of it, and he swore in some new officers. But it, there was a spontaneous singing of happy birthday around where we were singing for him. But it was not about him. It was about the Army and their 250th anniversary. And so I think that's the part they got wrong. The part they got right is, you know, it did cost some money. But what I learned while I was out here is the United States Army spends $2 billion with a B dollars per year recruiting individuals, men and women, to come into the armed forces. So whether this costs $25 million or $45 million, that'll be less than 3% of what they spend on an annual basis. And I'm telling you, this is going to turn into an unbelievably successful recruiting effort for the United States Army and all the armed forces.
How do you think they'll be able to leverage that if people weren't necessarily there? Because it was such a news-packed weekend that I feel like this is one of many, many things that happened over the weekend. So how do you think they're going to be able to flip it and use it as a recruitment tool for those who weren't there?
They can splice it. Again, the whole thing was narrated from start to finish. The one thing I would say is, probably was a little bit long, you know, 2.5 hours is a long time for people. And there were people for blocks and blocks and blocks along the parade route, which is one of the reasons they're having trouble sort of figuring out what the actual attendance was. It was several hundred thousand. I that's the best I could give you, but it was packed down there and it was fun.
All right. Well, good. And then things went well with your brother today?
Things went well with my brother. Yeah, he was appointed to be the administrator of the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway Development Corporation, which is quite an honor. He's been in the shipping industry in the Twin Ports of Duluth Superior for the last 45 years. And all the senior DOT officials showed up for the swearing in this morning. And one of them said to the chief of staff, "God, he's the most qualified guy we've ever had in that job." So it was really cool.
That is very cool. Congrats to him. Thanks for checking in with us, and safe travels. And we'll see you Friday.
See you Friday.
All Thanks. Right. Thanks, Bill. Big thanks to Bill McCaution for taking a couple minutes while he was waiting to board his flight to tell us about his experience at the parade. I would love to hear from you, 855-616-1620, from the coverage that you saw of the parade, what you thought of it. Did you think it was cool? Did you think it was overshadowed by the other events of the weekend? Was it what you expected? And I think it'll be interesting to see what Bill said, because he did text it to us, that he thinks this will be able to be used as a massive recruiting tool for the military, and what footage they got from that day, from Saturday, to be able to leverage that into recruitment tool. But yeah, would love to hear from you, 855-616-1620, on what you thought of the parade. Because I do think it's interesting. He thought that there was about several hundred thousand people there, and I don't know how they count these things, because there's also now trying to get some kind of count for how many people protested across the country. And I don't know how they get those numbers either. But there is one report that says that the No Kings Day was the biggest protest in U.S. history, according to one data analyst. So we will talk a little bit more about that after this on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and we talked a little bit about the parade in the last segment that happened in D.C. And, of course, there were also protests that happened all around Wisconsin and all around the country. Let me know if you went to a protest, 855-616-1620, and if you did, what you thought. I did go. I did not know if I was going to go or not. My mom wanted to go. And so they were in town for, my parents were in town for Father's Day weekend. And I would say since getting this job and working in the media, I try to be more thoughtful on certain things like that, of what I show up to and what I don't. And so I didn't know. I didn't know if I was going to go or not. And then when she was the one who was, "I really want to go." And she had never been to a protest ever in her life. She's a little bit too young to have been on college campuses during Vietnam protests. And was never, although I don't know if she did anything for the Women's March back in 2017. But she made it sound like she had never been to a protest before.
But anyway, since she wanted to go, I wanted to support her. And so we did go to the one that was in Cathedral Square in Milwaukee. And my reports of it, it was very chill. We didn't do the marching part. We were there for probably about an hour. The weather was great. Lots of people. What my mom noticed, she goes, there's a lot of people my age. And there really were. It was a lot of people, 50s, 60s, maybe even 70s. But all races, all ages. There weren't that many kids, but there were some kids. And overall, I feel like the vibe was pretty relaxed. It was almost like being at a street fair, except with more shouting and speakers instead of music. But I was happy to see for as many people turned out all across the country. It was very peaceful, and that seemed to be the vibe almost everywhere. And so, as I said in the last segment, I don't really know how they count these types of things and how they tally the number of how many people are at any one of these events. I know for Milwaukee, the estimates were approaching 10,000 people. And so I don't know if you take drone footage and there's some kind of estimation and technology or AI that can look at that and be like, yeah, this is about 10,000 people. I think Madison had maybe reports of around 15,000. But according to this, I saw this headline from the Daily Beast that across the country, No Kings was the biggest protest in U.S. history. And this was according to a nonpartisan data analyst called G. Elliot Morris. And they tweeted out, based on hundreds of crowdsourced records of No Kings Day events turnout, the extrapolating for the cities where we don't have data yet, it looks like roughly 4 to 6 million people protested Trump across the U.S. yesterday. 2 million variant seems like a pretty big range, but like I said, it'd be interesting to know. I don't know how they actually count this, but I would love to know if you were able to make a protest, 855-616-1620, what your thoughts were, if you got anything from it. Because I think that was one of the things that was interesting, especially for smaller areas. You probably expected in Milwaukee or Madison or Chicago or Philadelphia or New York that a lot of people would turn out. But I think what was interesting is the smaller, I think Brookfield had one. I don't know if Cedarburg had one, but different parts of our state where, you know, if you are on the side of being frustrated with what this administration is doing, but not knowing who else in your community also feels that way, I think there's probably more power in finding those relationships inside your own community in the smaller areas where maybe the turnout didn't, you know, was low compared to some of the bigger cities. But if maybe it was more impactful considering the purple or even red areas that still had people show up to this. So like I said, this was not, I'm happy I went. My mom was very happy she went. It still kind of paled in comparison to what I talked about on Friday, was the momentum of being in D.C. in 2017 and for the Women's March, where there was 500,000 people. That felt a little different than this. But nevertheless, let me know if you were there, what you thought. 855-616-1620. I will read some of those texts when we come back and wrap up the show on Point Taken.
Hey, WTMJ's John Mercure here for Orthopedic Hospital of Wisconsin, the best in the area. They're going to take care of you big time. You want to play pickleball. You want to golf. You want to play with your grandkids in the front yard and do it with no pain. Go to the place that has the highest patient satisfaction ratings and the top doctors in the area. It's Orthopedic Hospital of Wisconsin. I've met the docs. I've walked through the hospital. It's absolutely incredible. They're going to take great care of you from beginning to end. Go to OHOW.com. Hit the request an appointment button. OHOW.com. Request an appointment.
All right. Well, we are just about done for today. Steve will be here. I think he comes back on Wednesday. He might be very jet lagged, but I got a couple more shows without him, including tomorrow when we are going to be talking to the author of Misguided, Where Misinformation Starts, How It Spreads, and What to Do About It. So Matthew Ficciani is going to be joining us, and I'm really excited about this conversation because who doesn't want to have more tools in their tool belt to try to dispel misinformation and its impact on us. And then we are also going to be joined by Carmen Petrie from Sojourner House to talk a little bit about why she is in support of the renovations that need to happen for the public safety building. And also Jason Stein from Wisconsin Policy Forum is going to talk about our federal money that comes in and how we spend it. So big show coming tomorrow, but it was a very fun show today. Big thanks to Matt Smith, as always, for joining us, and Dave Spano. And thank you to everyone who reached out via text. I know that I had a fun time. It's always a different, very different show when you have Steve here to spar with versus monologuing. I think I prefer the other, but who knows? By the time he comes back, maybe I'll get used to it without him here. But as always, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow, and news is next.